Also, I love the use of the word braggadocious. I've got to point that one out. That's made me very happy. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the next stage. I'm Toby Vince, and I will be your host for this episode. Today, we are joined by Erin Quinlan, the writer and performer of Brian Hemingway. They will be performing at the Edinburgh Fringe this year, and they are on to talk all things about their show. We'll delve into the topics, not just surrounding Hemingway, but also about mental health, about musicals, a bit of Shakespeare as well. All sorts, a very packed episode for you. Take a listen. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the next stage. Today, for our Edinburgh Fringe special episode, I am joined by Erin Quinlan of Brian Hemingway. Hiya, you all right?
Hi, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very good, very good. Thank you for coming on, as ever.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Of course. So this is a bit of a question we're asking everybody who's part of our series, and we just want to kind of get an idea about what does fringe theatre mean to you?
So fringe theater for a while wasn't really something that was on my radar beyond knowing that it existed. Our understanding here in the States is a little bit different. We get kind of the little whispers of Ed Fringe, of fringes going on in Australia. I think we're just starting to get our own fringe culture. So I'd always wanted to do Edinburgh, and we finally did it last year, and it was just like an awakening. It was so wonderful, and it was so just kind of life affirming, not to be too dramatic about it. But so now I mean, I hear Fringe and my heart flutters.
No, that's basically, well, what would you say then is like, do you, not necessarily an equivalent, but more of like a cousin to fringe culture in American theatre? Would you say you have something that's along similar lines?
I suppose, we have theater festivals,
Yeah.
and those tend to be a little bit more curated by the festivals themselves. I think we do have some more fringe. There's the New York City Fringe now. I know that there was one recently in I think North Carolina. The closest thing for me in my level awareness would be a festival.
It's interesting to me, like hearing how theatre like shapes across the world, and it's interesting to me how you bring up the festival in Australia. I think that's, is that Adelaide? Is that right? Yeah,
Adelaide, yes, I
Adelaide
couldn't
Festival.
remember
Yeah,
what it was.
were you there?
No, I would love to be in Adelaide. Oh my goodness.
Super sunny, much nicer than Edinburgh in terms of weather, I would argue.
Last year, I think there was maybe 1 or 2 days of rain.
Really?
It was gorgeous the whole time. And maybe this could be rose-colored glasses for me, but I'm pretty sure last year was a really, really nice fringe.
Well, see, for Scotland, that amazes me because I am the English person talking about Scotland, which is dangerous territory anyway. So, but like in like it rains a lot up north, as far as we know. So I mean, hopefully it doesn't rain this year round. But we'll delve a bit more into your work while we're on the podcast today. So, you are on today to talk about your show called Brian Hemingway. So, would you give us a little bit of an insight into the play for us?
So Brian Hemingway is about a blocked playwright who is haunted by the subject of her last theatrical flop, who happens to be Ernest Hemingway.
And just to our audiences who are unfamiliar with him, because I'll be honest, like to me, Ernest Hemingway was a name. Like it was one of those people who's like, oh, I've heard him from somewhere. I don't know from where. So give us a bit of, so who was Hemingway and what is your relation to him as a playwright?
So Ernest Hemingway is an American author who was born in the early 1900s and who wrote between the 1920s until his death in the 1960s. And he was known for kind of pioneering the more modern writing of pared down sentences. Kind of going beyond that romantic style of writing that's a little bit more flowery and just trying to write what he called one true sentence. But he was also, I think more people know him for his personality than his writing, especially these days, where he is the the macho guy who goes out with his rifle and hunts kudu in Africa. And he was, he was always bopping around Africa and Key West and going camping and fishing and all of those manly man things and drinking and boxing and challenging people to fights. And I think that's what people kind of think of when they think of Hemingway.
That's and I'm guessing part of that has sort of. Well, actually, I mean, you can answer this question a bit more better than I. Has part of that sort of like macho aspect of Hemingway drew its way into your play, would you argue?
It definitely did because it's based on true life experiences where about 10 years ago I did a ton of research on Ernest Hemingway and I wrote a biographical musical about him
Okay.
and so I ended up learning a lot about him and one of the things that really intrigued me about Hemingway was how different he was from that public persona and how that public persona seemed to be curated by him, so that he was kind of portraying the person that he wanted most to be, but he was so full of contradictions, and I found that so fascinating. So when I wrote that show, I ended up, being quite a Hemingway scholar,
Yes.
and yes, accidentally. And so because of his, I guess what would you call his reputation in the United States in particular, when I would talk to people about Hemingway, men in particular, they would kind of talk down to me or get actually really defensive at some of the ideas that I had about him. And so all of that is in the show. So in Brain Hemingway, it's called Brain Hemingway because it is the version of Hemingway that now exists in my brain. And it's not a completely accurate version of Hemingway anymore because it's been 10 years, but
Yes.
it's really more the feelings that I remember from that time and the criticism I got or the difficulties I had trying to express myself about Hemingway, if that all makes sense.
Yeah, of course. It's like, so I think if audiences were to come and see the show, they're not expecting like, I don't know, a Daniel Day-Lewis version of Ernest Hemingway.
No,
No.
a lot of things. Actually, I when I wrote the first draft, I very, very intentionally did not look up anything.
Oh, really?
Yes, and I was surprised at how much I remembered. I actually remembered quite a bit, but there are some moments where Hemingway says incorrect things, and I end up correcting him, or we have to look it up on my phone. And there were moments where I would write the script and I would write a story and then just suddenly realize, oh, this is not what happened at all. So that was just kind of funny. And I don't want anyone coming to the show thinking that they can write a book report on Hemingway after seeing it, but you might accidentally learn a few things.
Yeah. And I mean, you never know what can come out of of a show. There may be something in it that I mean, while not necessarily like the Ernest Hemingway Wikipedia, there's probably some content in there that audience will be like, "Oh, I want to know who this man is now," you know, because you've got a version of Ernest Hemingway that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is through the lens of this female character who's leading it. Is that right?
Yes. And he, because of that, he is this macho, braggadocious type of person. He's definitely more of what people expect of Hemingway than what Hemingway might have actually been.
Also, I love the use of the word braggadocious. I've got to point that one out. That's made me very happy. So whilst this is kind of being like it's being advertised as a dark comedy, the show also falls into the genre of musical theatre, as you've mentioned. So this will include original numbers and choreography. What would you say the process of creating a piece of musical theatre is, and especially in the context of a fringe theatre?
So I've always written musical theater more than I have written straight plays. And I think that the main thing is, and this is what my mentor Paul Boyd is always asking me, why is it a musical? Why does it have to be a musical? And I find that question very annoying, but he's always right. And it always makes me think about, oh, why is this a musical? And Brain Hemingway is a musical because it is about someone who's having trouble writing a song and being in that person's brain. And so there has to be music, there has to be an engagement with that writing process. And it's not, obviously it's a two-person show and it's a fringe show. So it's not gonna be, the Ziegfeld Follies by any stretch of the imagination. It's a very small scale musical. And those limitations are kind of fun for me because they make you have to really think about, okay, well, how do we do these musical numbers in this space? How is this movement going to work here? And sometimes you come up with things that surprise you a bit.
Oh yeah, and you've just touched on something really important to fringe theatre, which is the how space is perceived. Because fringe theatre, I was having this conversation with another company who we've got on as well. You've got to think very laterally about like the sort of content that you produce, because fringe theatre, it's not going to be in those very traditional spaces. Part of that, from my perspective at least, is the allure, you know? But when it comes to like developing a musical as well, I mean, from a UK perspective, you always think of, okay, we're going to go to London to see a show, or we're going to go to one of the big theatres, or like the flagship theatre in the city to see the show. And we, so it's really interesting to me how you're thinking about, okay, we've got this space here. How are we able to reinterpret what is defined as musical and make it work for this capacity, you know?
And that's, I think, a lot of the times when people take a show to something like the Fringe or something like a smaller space, it tends to be, smaller cast, but also smaller production in general. And so the text itself, the play, is not going to be something that requires an entire, flagship style theater. And this show is, it's two people. It's one set. It's very dialogue driven. And so when those songs come in, I don't think people expect it to be something big and over the top. It's much more intimate than that. And so I think once you have the audience on board with the feel of the overall production, they come along with you for those smaller musical moments than what they might be used to.
And how have you kind of gone about the process of making the songs? Has it been a case of you've had the script first and then you've moved the songs around like that? Or was it a case of, okay, we've got a specific part in the script that I think we need to put a song in? Because you've mentioned that the show is about this playwright trying to write a song. So how have you gone about where we implement the songs and how you create them?
Well, the old chestnut about musical theater, and this is actually something I say in the play, is
Yes.
that in musical theater, the character feels so much that they can't speak the words, they have to sing the words. So usually in a typical musical theater show, those moments will be very obvious. They'll be talking about what they want or what they love or expounding on plans. And the other trick is that you always want the song to convey something where if an audience member misses the song, they're missing a plot point, whether it's about the character or about the plot itself. This show doesn't do that as much because it's about the playwright being blocked. It's about being unable to write a song. So there isn't a ton of music in most of it.
That's okay.
It's
That's okay.
still technically a musical, but it's about the inability to write the song. So there are a few moments of music. One of the other songs is actually from the Hemingway musical that I wrote 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
And then the last song, the finale song, is the song that I've been trying to write for the whole show. So it might feel a bit more like a musical scene because there's that thread of that last song going throughout it, which fits for something that is one act length, a 50-minute show. So it's not, I wouldn't call this a typical musical theater experience or as I guess a template.
Yeah, and that's the beauty, I think, of the work that's being put on at the Fringe, especially your one, in that it doesn't fit the mold of what we expect a musical to be, you know? It takes that, like, it takes a trope that we're familiar with, but it reinvents it in a way that allows us to, like, I think, view it from a different perspective and probably a more fresh and inspired one, I would say. So Brain Hemingway is making its return to the Fringe after being a surprise favourite of last year's festival. So I would like to ask you, what would you say you've learned from last year's run whilst at the Fringe, and how have you used that to develop the piece ready for this year?
I'm still figuring that one out
That's
because
okay.
it was our first Fringe. So we had no idea what to expect as far as audiences, as far as reception, as far as reviews, as far as standing out on the side of the street, giving out flyers. So this year we're just more prepared and we know what to expect. I'm still trying to find the happy medium of wanting to improve upon it and write the new draft and bring it to a more elevated place without getting too carried away and remembering that no matter what happens, it's really about being there and being with those people and being part of such a magical experience. So I'm still trying to kind of temper my, what I want to do with it versus what I need to do with it.
Yeah, and that's a really beautiful way of putting it. I think, and I mean, this is just from me speaking personally from like writing work. The hardest thing you can probably do as a playwright is stop writing when you're in the groove of it, you know? So taking a bit more of a measured approach and thinking about, okay, well, oh, there goes my voice. Taking a more measured approach and thinking about, okay, well, here's what worked last time. These are the parts that I really enjoyed as an artist, and this is what I sort of want to expand on. I think are really key takeaways with like how you go about like evolving a show.
And not being influenced by kind of the outside chatter, I guess.
Yeah, completely. Because at the end of the day, you still want it to be your show. Like it's good to have that feedback and those reviews to come in, but it's also important to remember, okay, look, this is my show, not theirs. Whilst the reviews are valuable, don't get me wrong, it's important to recognise whether you're writing a show that you're happy with, or whether you're writing a show just to appease someone else. And I think you can tell, just as a audience member, you can tell like what kind of show it is, and you're more likely to enjoy the show that an artist has enjoyed making the work for.
Yes, I think it's especially at the Fringe. I think the audiences are very canny and they are able to tell kind of genuine connection versus a something that's been kind of put through the sausage grinder for the purposes of going viral or being shocking or something like that. I think they are able to form a genuine connection with the plays because they're such intimate settings. And sometimes you'll be in a show and there are two people in the audience and you have to direct the entire thing towards them. And there's something really unique about that experience.
Oh,
And I
yeah.
think some people can find that humbling and some people can find that special. And we definitely chose to find it special, and I think that that worked in our favor.
Listen, we are going to take a quick break for a moment. We are with Erin from Brian Hemingway. We'll be right back. And we're back. So, you touched up on this a little bit in the first part, but I want to talk about it more. Although Hemingway is a core aspect of this production, the work also explores like the mental health of artists within the industry. And you said the show references like as a script, like bad reviews you've had personally for previous work that you've made. So why was this a subject you wanted to tackle, and how does Hemingway play into this for you?
So it kind of started pretty naturally. It was during lockdown, during COVID, and I think I, like many people, were sort of trying to figure out, okay, how do I be creative in this situation when it's just so depressing and so hopeless and fraught, and there's an election coming up, and it's winter time, and it's just dark, and I just noticed that I was saying a lot of things to myself that weren't terribly kind. And I realized that a lot of those were things that people had said to me, either about my work or about whether it was Hemingway or something else. But I had internalized a lot of things that people s said to me about my work. So as an exercise, I was kind of thinking, oh, what if I write a conversation between me and Hemingway and just sort of hash it out? About how irritated I am that he's still in there in my brain, and that people still connect me to him because of something I did so long ago. And people send me emails about how, oh, I read this about Hemingway, thought you'd like it. All of those kinds of
Yes.
little things that were annoying, and it turned into a bigger piece of work, and it ended up being very therapeutic. But it came up totally unexpected.
Well, speaking as me personally, when it was lockdown in the UK, like at the start, so we're talking for us it'd be March 2020, it was a very different political climate. In that, I think, I won't go too much into it, but I think that for me, I was like right in the middle of my studies. So we just had like this massive pause where nobody was sure what to do. And I too personally found a lot of like, I think, mental stability in writing. Even if it wasn't necessarily about like COVID or lockdown or whatever. Just writing something, I think, really did a lot of wonders for my mental health during that period. And just like yourself, I've had productions I wrote that actually come up into fruition and become like physical things. So it's interesting how it's interesting how being in those sorts of like pressurized situations where you like your mental health, it's inevitably going to take a knock, right?
Oh yeah, it's nice to have that sort of lifeline where you can, whether it be writing plays or songs or poetry or prose, that kind of like freeing your brain, and you're stuck here, but your brain can go there. And I actually took up when I was a kid, I used to write a lot of fan fiction.
Yes.
And during COVID, I started writing a Game of Thrones fan fiction, and it was the only thing that saved my brain for a really long time. Just because there's something just freeing about just sitting and writing and pretending and, joining another world for a little bit, can be so healthy.
Oh yeah, it's about being able to separate yourself, I think, from it all. And I think that's what really is not only therapeutic, but it really helps get the creative juices flowing. Because even in even if we take Brian Hemingway for an example, although it is based on your personal experiences, or it has been inspired by moments from that in the past, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think the character in it is specifically you as Erin. It's sort of it's a miscellaneous character. It's good to have those. It's good to have that detachment, I think, from work a little bit sometimes. So continuing on this, so when you sent out the press release for the show, there was a line that really stuck out in my head whilst doing some research, and it said, "What does a little girl like you have to say about a big man like Hemingway?" And that is, and I mean, it's a powerful line as it is, right? But I would like to know, well, first of all, how did you get to having that line in the script? And why did you want to include it?
Well, so many of the really negative things that Hemingway says to me are things that people have actually said to me. In my process of researching Hemingway or in reviews, this particular instance, I was talking to someone who had known Hemingway personally,
Okay.
and there were a couple of times where, there was a touch on the shoulder, or saying, "Oh, if I knew you were this cute, I would have, it suggested that it was dinner instead of breakfast," or stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
And he asked me, "What does a little girl like you have to say about a big man like Hemingway?" Implying that there were already so many things said about Hemingway, what would I possibly
Have to add
add?
to the conversation, yeah.
Yes. And I think back to that moment because, it's the wit of the staircase thing where you think of a billion things to say after the moment, or you think about just standing up and going, "I won't be spoken to like that." But I was quite young, those 10 years ago at least, probably more. And you have that feeling of just wanting to be polite, even when someone said something so impolite to you.
Oh,
And
yeah.
so I was very, "Oh, well, I don't know. I don't know. I just have I was very flustered. And I just kind of let him say that. And to me, that represents something I've had to deal with a lot of times in my career with various men. And it just says it all. It just says, "What are you doing here? Who do you think you are?" And I had no answer for that. And that, I think, is what kind of compelled me to write this. And what I got from the end of it is a feeling of, I do belong here. And I did write this. And now I own that phrase. And it exists. And you know about it. And other people know about it because I chose to put it in the show. And it gets a laugh in the show. And so now I own that. That's what I have to say about a big man like Hemingway.
Yeah, there's definitely beauty in sort of reclamation of that, isn't there? And you're touching on a wider issue beyond theatre when it comes to patriarchal views on these things, especially scholarly things. But it really struck me how when reading that and hearing about the experience of it that that when it comes to certain writers, for example, or wanting to do work about certain writers, there can be so much elitism when creating new stuff. There's a very famous case in the UK quite recently of do you know Samuel Beckett, Waiting for Godot? Yeah. There was a very famous case in the UK quite recently of a production called Godot is a Woman. Yeah, and now for anybody listening who doesn't know about Samuel Beckett or Waiting for Godot, etc., if you want to do a piece of Samuel Beckett, more often than not, you will have to go through the Beckett estate, who owns the property to the work. Now, what that means is that you have to say to them, here's what we want to do with the work. We want your permission to be able to do it. Now, like that's a very normal thing because again it's touching on somebody's intellectual property, you know, and like in the interests of preserving like a person's work, most people and places will do that. However, the reason why the Beckett estate is like a bit of a touchy one is because they're very specific about the way things have to be produced. And the reason why Godot is a woman was quite controversial was because like I can't f I think it I'd have to give it a research, but off the top of my head, I think it was possibly one of the first productions to like include the two main characters, Vladimir and Estragon, as women, you know? Because like that's something which like as I think doesn't fly, you know? So it's so interesting how like elite places can be about certain people's work, isn't it?
It really is. And there's so many interesting, philosophical conversations to have about it. I don't think there's a one blanket answer for every person's work. But there is something to say about, is this a museum piece? Is this supposed to be just reflective of the time in which it was written and the circumstances under which it was written, or is it meant to be a commentary to any period and therefore should be changed to be influenced by what's going on in the world right now? And I think it would be I would usually say it would be the latter because that's art and that's the magic of art.
And I mean, I use this argument with Shakespeare a lot, where how does a man who's been dead for going on 400, 500 years still be the most performed playwright in the world? And that's because, at least in my opinion, his work has license to be able to be reinvented or reinterpreted or changed in order to make it more relevant to the modern day audiences. And I think having that sort of elitism when it comes to work is, I mean, it's obviously not a good thing, but it's about knowing to find a balance between, okay, how am I preserving the original person's like perspective? How am I being true to this, but also doing it in a way where, you know, I'm not creating a carbon copy. I'm doing something that is true to me as an artist, you know?
Absolutely. And I mean, I have conversations with my husband Evan about this all the time. Shakespeare's Globe and how many different iterations they've gone through at that theater. First doing more of a museum piece type thing, and Emma Rice's artistic directorialship, and how that kind of had a mixture of the modern and the past. And now they've kind of gone totally, as far as I'm concerned, just off the wall. I miss the museum pieces because that felt new. It felt like everything was coming back around and they're using traditional instruments and people are laughing. Funniest Hamlet I've ever seen.
Yes.
So it's just interesting, when you put on Shakespeare, are you thinking I want to put my mark on it, or are you thinking I want the audience to feel this in a way that they've never felt before. And I think too often people go for the, I'm going to put my mark on it. And that means everyone's in spandex and we're going to have a golden toilet on the stage.
Which does or does not feature in Brian Hemingway, can I ask?
No, not this time.
Oh, next time though, next
Next
time.
time, maybe
No.
draft three.
But it is interesting though what you say. And I think and I mean this is just from personal opinion. You have with Shakespeare's Globe down in London, part of its appeal is the fact that the venue's a reconstruction. So you kind of come to expect that you want the authentic late 1500s Shakespeare experience, you know? So
Yeah,
it's
you can't get that anywhere else.
no.
Ironically, they're trying to reinvent the wheel a bit, and they already had it. They already had what no one else is doing.
Yeah. And because I mean, for me personally, I live quite close to the RSC, Royal Shakespeare Company, and that's in
Right.
Stratford-upon-Avon, and they're known for like proper like taking spins and stuff on the work because that's sort of their brand. That's what they like to do. And but still they're faithful to the original work. And I mean, I suppose with your case with Brian Hemingway, yes, although Hemingway is a is a character that is altered to be through the perspective of someone, it's they've still got that iteration of the Hemingway that audiences will know and be able to research, you know?
And that was kind of it was important to me to show a Hemingway that people would expect at the front of the show, just so they're willing to come along with me. As I said before, they know that I'm not being, kind of angry feminist about it. But I do try to drop in little unexpected facts about him. The idea that I think a lot of people think of Hemingway as a guy who's drinking, whiskey on the rocks, and he actually really loved a daiquiri. That was his favorite drink. He created a daiquiri recipe. And you don't expect, the big macho guy to be drinking this, drink with an umbrella, but there you go. He contradicts himself. And that's what I find fascinating about him. And I hope that other people find that, kind of the contradictive self of, but none of us are just one thing. And so why do we insist on making people one thing?
Completely on the same page with you on that one. So if we consider then the journey that the show's been on, from its early stages, whether that be last year, maybe 10 years ago from the original Hemingway musical you wrote, what do you want audiences to take away when they come to Edinburgh Fringe and see Brian Hemingway?
What I keep coming back to is just the idea that when someone says something to you that hurts your feelings, they say it to you once, and then once you internalize that, you're the one saying it to yourself over and over again. And I think we all tend to do that, but artists often get that criticism in writing that they can go back and Google and continue to look at over and over and over again. And just sort of what does that do to a person? How does that affect what you're capable of doing, how do you change that voice and make it work for you? And so that is, I hope that's kind of a catharsis for people to kind of realize that we're all feeling that.
Yeah, and I think like it probably would also bring a lot of solace, I would say, to people as well, in that, obviously mental health is definitely a growing topic, but it's something that, I mean, personally speaking, I don't think it could probably ever be talked about enough. So it's important to be able to have mediums of storytelling that touch upon that and audiences maybe not even not in a direct way, but nonetheless will still have that feeling of being like, okay, I'm not alone in this, because there's bound to be people who turn up to the Edinburgh Fringe who they might be there for the first time, they might be an aspiring artist themselves, so there's bound to be people who will engage with your work and sort of feel a resonance and like honestly comfort in knowing that through the experience that you've gone through, they've still got to this point, you know?
Yeah, and I think that was what people came away with last time, and I was so pleased because I had no idea what to expect last time. So I would really just hope that I can still stick the landing as far as that one goes.
Listen, Erin, thank you so much for coming on. Like, it's honestly been a real pleasure getting to speak to you and talk all about the show. Before we cut off the episode, I'd like to ask you, what is the next stage for you and Brian Hemingway? So, what can we expect from you during and after the Edinburgh Fringe?
So during the Fringe, it's going to be Brain Hemingway. And then after that, I'll collapse for a bit, probably. And then I have a few things I'm writing that I'm working on, but nothing, everything is being directed at this. Every brain cell is being directed at this. So
Yes.
I can't think past August.
Of course. And I mean, once it's done, a long deserved holiday, I imagine, is on the cards. If
I always
indeed we
say
can
that.
get there.
I always say that, and then I get antsy, and I'm back to, okay, what's the next thing? The
Nah,
next thing's
yeah.
not on the books yet. Oh God, I'm never gonna work again. So it never lasts long.
Of course. Where can we find you online?
So you can find us on Instagram and TikTok at Tawny Dog Productions, and then we're at brainhemingway.com as well.
Amazing stuff. Erin, again, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Brian Hemingway. All the relevant information for you who's listening to the episode will be in the description. Go get your tickets for the show, go and support the artist whilst you're in Edinburgh. And yeah, thank you again, Erin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Erin from Brian Hemingway. As you heard, it's an incredible show. I really highly recommend you go to Edinburgh and see it whilst it's up there. I will give you a bit more information about the show now and where to find it. So, Brian Hemingway plays from the 4th to the 12th, 14th to the 19th, and 21st to the 26th of August, and that will be at the Green Side at Nicholson Square's Fern Studios. Shows will begin at 5:30 and they last 50 minutes. You can get your tickets online through the Edinburgh Fringe website or through brianhemingway.com. I will give you all of the relevant information you need down in the episode description. Once again, this is the Edinburgh Fringe podcast special that we have for you. We've got a whole host of different artists available for you to listen to, not just from musical, but from immersive, from comedy to drama, from solo. We've got a whole load for you. So stay tuned. And for now, we'll see you at the next stage.